Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan. For data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Rev up your thrills this summer at Cedar Point on the all-new Top Thrill 2. Drive the sky on the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch vertical speedway. And now, for a limited time, get more Cedar Point fun for less with our limited-time bundle for just $49.99. Get admission, parking, and all-day drinks for one low price. But you better hurry, because this bundle won't last long. Save now at CedarPoint.com.
AT&T connects an ode to podcasts. Connect the alarm. Change the podcast you stream. Connect the snooze. 10 more minutes to dream. Connect the shower. Lather up with the news, sports talk, comedians, or movie reviews. Connect with that 3-hour philosophy show. Change the drive into work in traffic so slow. Connect the dishes to voices that glow. Thank you to the geniuses of spoken audio. Connect the stories. Change your perspective. Connecting changes everything. AT&T.
Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind, a production of iHeartRadio's How Stuff Works.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Joe McCormick, and we're back with part three of our exploration of psychedelics, these compounds that lead to the mind manifesting experiences, which we've been describing in the past couple of episodes. Now, if you're just tuning in, we recommend that you probably should go and check out the previous two episodes first. This is probably one it's not best to jump in midstream.
Right. Yeah, it's a continuous, though at times meandering journey through the history of psychedelics. Not an all-inclusive history, so we've stressed multiple times, you know, there's no way that we can cover all of the studies, all of the curious tidbits of history, all the various traditional uses of psychedelic substances. So certainly we implore you to check out some of the sources we've mentioned here and explore them for yourselves, as well as, you know, additional resources.
Right. And so in the previous episodes, we mentioned some books that have been part of our guides on the way through. I know you've been enjoying some of the works of Terrence McKenna.
And Michael Pollan as well. We've both been reading on that.
Yeah, Michael Pollan's most recent book, How to Change Your Mind, is a great book about psychedelics that covers a lot of the same ground, some history, some science, and especially this recent renaissance in psychedelic research and how it there's renewed interest, I think, since like the early to mid 2000s, especially about the clinical significance of psychedelics, how they could actually be used to treat mental conditions, addictions, various problems people have, and that they're not just a recreational drug, though there are also plenty of people who would make the case that it might not be a bad thing to use them recreationally. We're not going to try to evangelize or demonize either way or recommend that you use them. We just want to be descriptive.
Right. But we will discuss some of these viewpoints that are brought up regarding the beyond medicinal uses of psychedelics.
Right.
As far as the modern stuff, like, again, we're living in an exciting time when there are all these current studies going on that are revealing more and more about how psychedelics can be used to help treat various problems, psychological problems, addictions, et cetera. We're probably going to get into most of that in the following episode. This episode is largely going to deal with some of the original studies that were taking place, especially in the 1950s.
Yeah. This is a thing that comes as a surprise to a lot of people who, you know, if you think about the the origins of the drug war, the counterculture of the 1960s, and I don't know, maybe you have some various ideas about the square 1950s, it might come as a shock to you that there was a flourishing body of psychedelic research going on during the 1950s and early 1960s, especially focusing on LSD and the treatment of things like alcoholism in the 1950s, and then you, later the use of psilocybin in various types of research in the early to mid-1960s.
Yeah, psychedelics did not just emerge from a van at Woodstock and start corrupting the youth of America. Now, before we go any further, I do want to take a step back for just a little bit, and I wanted to talk about fungi, or fungi, if you will. Just in general.
Fungi if you're making a pizza. Isn't that the Italian way to say it?
I've also watched like British documentaries where they prefer fungi.
Uh-huh.
But I'm more of a fun guy, so I tend to go for fungi.
Let's go with fungi.
All right. So I just want to take a step back and just talk about just how weird and wonderful the entire kingdom of fungi really is.
Yeah. Well, we should say the reason for that, of course, if you've been with us the last two episodes, is that of all the psychedelics that we've looked at, the most focus has been on psilocybin mushrooms.
Right. And even LSD is derived from ergot, which is a fungi.
Yeah.
So the fungal element here is very rich and fecund.
Yes.
So, the kingdom fungi, because fungi are their own kingdom. We often associate them with plants in kind of an informal way, but they were considered plants up until the later half of the 20th century. But there's something different, of course. They're thought to outnumber plant species on a scale of 10 to 1, and they all descend from a single species that derived from a common ancestor with animals about 800 million to 900 million years ago.
Is it true that phylogenetically, humans are more closely related to fungi than to plants? I think that's correct.
That is what I have read.
Yeah.
And it's an amazing thing to think about. It's also something that, it's that fact that leads some people to wonder about our relationship with fungi.
Mm-hmm.
Why in some cases we have this this close relationship, because ultimately fungi have a lot more in common with us than they do with plants. and again, that's interesting considering the close relationship we have with them. And not only us, there are other animals as well. I mean, think to the leafcutter ants that stand out as one of the most impressive fungi-dependent species due to their practice of fungal agriculture.
Yeah, they're mushroom farmers.
Yeah. Because when you think about how humans use fungi, we've certainly been focusing on psychedelics, but certainly fungi factor into our cuisine, into our medicines, both in major ways, but and also in ways we don't, major in obvious ways, but also in ways we maybe don't think about as much. Because certainly you think about cooking in mushrooms, you think about culinary mushrooms that you buy at the store.
Which I love. Mushrooms, one of my favorite ingredients.
Yeah. And of course, not every edible mushroom can be cultivated. I got to learn about this over the weekend. I went with a licensed herbalist on a mushroom foraging walk.
Mm-hmm.
And we got to pick a few different mushrooms that cannot be cultivated, or at least can't be cultivated in a dependable manner. And got to bring some home and eat them.
Is that why chanterelles are so expensive? You can't grow them on a farm?
Yeah. Well, I forget the exact species, but there are several varieties like that where if a local restaurant is serving them, they have to depend on foragers bringing them in and selling them. And so a lot of mushroom enthusiasts kind of pay for their hobby by selling their mushrooms to local restaurants.
Hmm. Yeah. Interesting.
But yeah, so there's that level. Obviously, we eat them, but they're also, ingredients in many different foods, especially modern processed foods, and they're an important part, an essential part of the fermentation process.
Oh yeah, yeast.
Yeah. And you don't have to be drinking some sort of weird mushroom tea to be partaking of medicinal fungi, because, of course, we have penicillin to consider.
Oh yeah.
Which, is I would love to do a future episode of our other podcast, Invention, on penicillin, because in terms of fungal inventions or discoveries, however you want to describe it, like that is a major one.
Yeah.
And it is totally fungi dependent.
It came from mold growth, right?
Yeah.
Which, of course, is a fungus.
And then on top of that, we talk about the microbiome a lot, but we also have a mycobiome, which is a small but significant portion of the human body's overall microbiome. Fungi also play a crucial role in the nutrient exchange of trees, growing around their roots like fungal gloves and exchanging nitrogen for sugars. And this forms the basis of what some researchers call the wood wide web, which is kind of
that's a little too cute.
It's a little too cute because ultimately it's like really just mind-blowingly weird to think about, because we're talking about a fungal network of hyphae. Remember that a mushroom, we often think of the mushroom as the thing itself, but the mushroom is just the fruiting body and the spore-spewing death emergence of a larger organism. So this network of hyphae underground and growing around the trees and between trees, it allows for the plants to distribute resources such as sugar, nitrogen, and phosphorus, between one tree and another. And by some definitions, this comprises a form of communication.
These types of thinking can get really psychedelic on their own.
Oh, absolutely. Mycologist Paul Stamets, for instance, who did we mention?
Oh, yeah. He came up several times.
So, yeah, he's like a mushroom answer for everything guy, very important figure in modern mycology. And he's gone so far as to suggest, according to Michael Pollan in his book, that these networks are in some sense conscious, that they're aware of their environment and they're able to respond to challenges accordingly. And Pollan says that initially he thought this was mere metaphor, that clearly Stamets is just being overly enthusiastic and metaphoric about what's going on with these systems, but that he thinks that growing evidence actually suggests that there might be more involved here.
Well, I think this depends heavily on just simply what you mean when you use the word conscious,
right?
Because I think you can definitely make the case that mushrooms in very interesting and surprising ways are aware of their environments, able to respond to stimuli and stuff like that. I think it would be much harder to make the case that, the thing that we think of as like the hard problem of consciousness, meaning that it is having a subjective experience. There's something that it's like to be the mushroom.
Yeah.
I'm not saying that that's not true, but I don't know like what the evidence for that would be.
I think it's much more of a stretch to make that case. Now, on a similar lines, though, I got to hear Eduardo Cohn, associate professor of anthropology at McGill University, speak on basically the same topic at the 2019 World Science Festival. He's the author of a book titled How Forests Think, and he's worked extensively with Amazonian people in his work, especially concerning their use of psychedelic substances.
But he's focused on the same issue of like the use of fungal networks in the soil within forests as a type of communication or even thought.
Yeah, he gets into this as well. So just to give you an idea, because it's ultimately kind of a heady concept, but it's basically this idea that you have non-human entities that quote unquote think via an ability to represent, produce, and interpret signs.
Interesting.
And this is a quote from his book, How Forests Think. Quote, "Life is constitutively semiotic. That is, life is, through and through, the product of sign processes. What differentiates life from the inanimate physical world is that life forms represent the world in some way or another, and these representations are intrinsic to their being. What we share with non-human living creatures, then, is not our embodiment, as certain strains of phenomenological approaches would hold, but the fact that we all live with and through signs. We all use signs as canes that represent part of the world to us in some way or another. In doing so, signs make us what we are."
Interesting. Semiotic definition of life. I don't know if I've ever encountered that before. And I took a class on semiotics.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, no, I was that kind of weirdo.
Well, I'm very interested in his thoughts and his work. I'd love to actually see about having him on the show in the future.
Mm-hmm.
But like I said, he's worked extensively with Amazonian peoples and explored their use of ayahuasca. And he said that Amazonians use several technologies, including psychedelics, but also dreams, to connect with the mind of the forest. And he says that these approaches break down the way language tells us what we are. They help them find a path forward, a path of healing and problem solving. And he also pointed out that the shamans of the Amazon like basically have a message for the rest of the world. They want us to know that the world is a living world and that we have to connect ourselves with the mind of the forest to save ourselves from the planetary depression that we are now entering into. And I found this really interesting because this is, even though Cone, to my knowledge, never mentions Terence McKenna in his work, but some of this like lines up with the messages that McKenna had in The Food of the Gods and his other work regarding this idea of an archaic revival, a necessary reconvergence with the natural world through psychedelics and at least in McKenna's definition, an overall, you know, bohemian thread of human cultures to save us from the, you know, the doom of a nature-deprived, ego-driven dominator culture.
To save us from silent running.
Yeah, yeah, in a way. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it matches up with this theory. I mean, this this viewpoint of modern life. We'll come back to this. That you see this throughout a lot of psychedelic literature and also just sort of counterculture 1960s messaging, including Silent Running, which was very much a product of that time. The science fiction film that we've discussed previously on the show. Now, Cone mentioned at the World Science Festival that he thinks even our modern fascination with psychedelics may be a symptom of our disconnection with nature. And he says the solution isn't simply to take a psychedelic substance, but to rather live psychedelically, to live to be in the emergent mind.
What exactly do you think he meant by that quote? What does the emergent mind mean there?
My understanding, and like I say, perhaps we can get him on the show to discuss these topics in greater depth, but I think he's talking about this basic idea that, again, you see again and again among advocates of psychedelic, that there's something wrong with modern humans, that we're cut off from each other, that we're sort of in these little individual cells of the mind, and we are, in many cases, have great difficulty in being part of some sort of a larger system. It may be a bit elaborate to think of it. I mean, I don't know if I would describe it, and my understanding is like an emergent mind, you know, but that's kind of the vibe I get from it. The idea that we're cut off from each other. That we don't understand each other. We don't understand nature. We're all, wrapped up in our own egos. And if we could break through those boundaries, that we would have a better relationship with each other and with the world.
Like so often in the world of psychedelics and stuff coming from psychedelic enthusiasts, that's the kind of statement that is either truly profound or extremely banal.
Yeah, I mean, I get it, because I know a lot of people out there are probably shaking their hands and saying, like, well, that just sounds like hippie nonsense. And it's not even new hippie nonsense. It's hippie nonsense I've heard time and time again. But for my own part, you know, I think, yeah, you can be overly optimistic about a lot of this stuff. But on the other hand, you know, you look at the literature, the scientific literature, that shows us and is continuing to show us what psychedelics can do. I think at this point, it's more a question of like, at what level are psychedelics useful? Is it purely in the clinical world? Is it purely among people who are suffering from some condition or another, or does it go beyond that? You know, I think it depends on who's advocating on where that line should be drawn. I mean, some people draw it all the way at the horizon.
Where you draw it, I think, is clearly a source of the conflict that led to the demonization of psychedelics and to the sort of closing of the psychedelic research regime in the mid to late 1960s, right?
Yeah. Well, on that note, let's go to the 1960s. In fact, let's go to the 1950s.
Okay.
Let's go back.
Let's go to the 1940s.
Let's do it. I'll take you up on that. We'll go all the way back to the 40s, and let's just discuss 20th century psychedelic research itself. So, as we've discussed, most of these substances are nothing new. Humans have used them for thousands of years. And even the synthesized substance LSD, of course, is derived from ergot fungi that has been around forever as well.
Right.
But there was certainly a period of time between Albert Hofmann's 1943 bicycle ride and Nixon's Controlled Substance Act of 1970, in which there were tons of studies that examined psychedelics, and especially LSD in many cases, because it was more readily available at the time.
One reason also, I think, is that the pharmaceutical manufacturer that Albert Hofmann worked for in the 1930s and 40s, Sandoz, which I guess held the patent on LSD,
right,
was just giving it out like candy, basically.
Yeah,
I think they were trying to find uses for it. And their method of doing that was like, well, let's just give it for free to tons of researchers and they'll find a good way to use it.
Yeah, it's kind of like in The Lorax, the Sneed was invented, which everyone needs. Like if you invented this thing that clearly has some sort of use, but you're not exactly sure how to market it. You're not sure what the use is for it. You kind of just let everybody play with it until you can figure out how you're going to make your billions of dollars off of it.
Uh-huh. But I don't say that to undermine the fact that it really does seem like some researchers were finding extremely promising clinical uses for LSD in the 1950s.
Yeah, particularly in how they might be used to treat addiction, depression, obsessive compulsive disorder, schizophrenia, autism, and end-of-life anxiety. So in his book, Michael Pollan chats with Stephen Ross, MD, of the NYU psilocybin cancer anxiety study. Which, of course, comes back to that end-of-life anxiety question that was explored earlier.
I guess we'll explore that more probably in the next episode.
Yeah, we will. But in the book, Ross mentions to Pollan that, you know, these efforts involved roughly 40,000 research participants and more than 1,000 clinical papers. So when we're talking about LSD studies of the 1950s, for instance, you know, we're not talking about we're going to highlight a few isolated studies, but we're not talking about like just a study here, a study there. You know, there was a lot of research going on.
Yeah, it was huge. It wasn't just a blip.
Yeah. And initially, researchers thought that LSD and later psilocybin, that they might be used to understand psychosis, as they believed that individuals who were using these substances displayed similar thoughts and behavior. And so clinicians also thought that, well, you could take one of these substances yourself and therefore get a taste of what a psychotic episode is like and then be better able to empathize with a patient.
Exactly. And in this vein, the same compounds we now refer to as psychedelic were then referred to by many clinicians as psychotomimetics, mimicking the state of psychosis. So your therapist could take this in order to understand what you were going through.
Now, a key figure from this period, English psychiatrist Humphrey Osmond entered the picture, and he figured that, okay, if you had a substance like mescaline, and if it could induce this sort of symptom, these sort of symptoms in a human who took it, then perhaps, schizophrenia was due to a chemical imbalance in the brain, which is kind of, ultimately an eye-opening hypothesis, right? If this substance makes my brain do this, then perhaps what this patient's brain is doing is due to something, very chemical in nature as well, something that could be addressed, perhaps with another chemical.
Well, yeah, I mean, and I think this middle of the 20th century period was actually a very important time for understanding the role of physical causes in mental phenomena. There was, of course, the rise of Skinnerism, like B.F. Skinner, behaviorism, which you can have lots of criticisms about. Maybe it doesn't take into account cognition and the mind and enough about what our thoughts and emotions mean, because it was just about what can we do to control and measure external behaviors, because that's the only thing we have access to as scientists. So that might not be the right approach, but it was certainly useful in some ways to kind of clear out, I think, a lot of the kind of almost religious kind of metaphysical baggage that had been coming along for the ride with some versions of psychology up until then with, Freud and Jung and all that.
Yeah. So ultimately we have this push for biochemical answers to, concerning mental issues. And this propels the young field of neurochemistry, leading in time to our modern understanding of neurotransmitters and their role in our mental states, leading to the discovery of serotonin and the development of SSRI antidepressant drugs.
Mm-hmm.
But then, some also made the connection between the symptoms of psychedelic use and delirium tremens, or the DTs.
Mm-hmm.
This is, of course, associated with alcohol abuse, alcoholism.
Alcohol withdrawal,
yes,
I think.
Yeah.
So like if you're used to extensive alcohol consumption and then somebody stops, they might experience these negative symptoms that have been referred to as the delirium tremens.
Yeah. So this led by modern, from a modern viewpoint, kind of a weird-seeming idea, that you could use LSD to sort of shock alcoholics into sobriety. And so Osmond and a gentleman by the name of Abram Hoffer conducted these studies with hundreds, I think 700, according to Pollan, alcoholics, and they found it effective roughly half the time.
You mean using LSD to treat alcoholics?
Yes, yes. And this particular study, by the way, was one of the ones that caught the eyes of Stephen Ross decades later as an example of the therapeutic potential of psychedelics, quote, buried in plain sight.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, the original researchers here, they expected that the trips in question, the psychedelic experiences in question, would be essentially just nightmare fuel that would approximate the feelings of the DTs. And this was seemingly based on physician Sidney Katz's reports that Pollan summarizes as being something like you'd see in an anti-LSD propaganda from the 1960s.
Right.
Just about how it was just, you know, just pure nightmare fuel and, you know, just running from demons sort of a thing. Of course, what happened is that they gave, in their study anyway, they found that when they gave these substances to people, they reported all manner of things, beautiful things even. So there was definitely some anxiety, some depression, some hallucination in individuals when they were administered psychedelics. But most reported feelings that were described as transcendental in nature. So, that, for instance, an ability to see oneself objectively, almost as if for the first time.
Hmm.
And so this would seem to be the experience, or this was possibly an experience that was playing a role in them then being able to cease their addiction. And, of course, outside of the black box of experience, the research results spoke for themselves and indicated that, you know, something was working here. So this opened up the idea that there was something more to the experience and that it might be utilized as a treatment method.
Now, I know it was especially in Canada that
yes.
That LSD treatment for alcoholism was picked up. And I think,
I think this particular study was in Saskatchewan, I believe.
Yeah. Well, I think that was where Humphrey Osmond was mm-hmm. based for a long time. Another thing I think to make clear is that it's not thought that just giving somebody the drug triggers a change in the body that defeats alcoholism.
Correct. Yeah.
That there's something important going on about the nature of the experience that people have on psychedelics that contributes to their recovery and staying sober over time, right?
Right, yeah. This sort of this metaphorical shaking of the snow globe, mm-hmm. as some call it, is playing a role in allowing some sort of curative therapy to take place. Now, I should point out that in terms of this particular study, later on in the early 60s, the Addiction Research Foundation in Toronto set out to replicate these results with better controls, and they failed to reproduce the same robust results. And this ended up giving fuel to critics of LSD, but also supporters again stressed the importance of set and setting.
Right. I mean, this is something that I guess we'll come back to this in a minute, so I'll save my tangent here
yes.
for later.
But yeah, we'll put a pin in that and just know that we're okay. going to come back to the importance of set and setting in research. But there was enough going on here that people were very encouraged. And by the end of the 1950s, LSD was considered like a miracle cure for alcohol addiction. A lot of people were excited about it. And Pollan points out that one of the people that ended up getting excited about it was none other than Bill Wilson, co-founder of Alcoholics Anonymous.
Hmm.
Yeah, who incidentally credited his own sobriety to a life-changing mystical experience he had on belladonna, which also has psychoactive properties and was used in treatment at Towns Hospital in New York City in 1934. That's when he had the substance as part of the treatment.
Uh-huh. And so you can see that in a lot of the Alcoholics Anonymous messaging, like the idea mm-hmm. of the idea of acknowledging a higher power. You know, I think a lot of times people just interpret that as a more traditional kind of, like, you know, you need a religion or something.
Yeah, I mean, especially if you're meeting in a church basement or something.
Yeah, but in fact, it seems like this has something to do with the common kinds of mystical experiences that people have on psychedelics, where they, you know, they commune with some kind of reality greater than themselves. They believe that they've encountered some other being or some universal consciousness or the universe itself. It might have something to do with the ego dissolution that sometimes people experience on psychedelics.
Wilson, by the way, would later try LSD with some researchers in LA, and he actually thought that it might prove very useful in treating alcoholism and that it might even have a place in AA. But others in the organization struck down this idea, you know, for a few different reasons, one of which being that it would perhaps muddy the messaging of the organization itself.
Right. Like, you know, that you would turn to another chemical.
Right.
Yeah. And so for a time, LSD-assisted psychotherapy was considered a powerful, legitimate, and evidence-based method for treating alcoholism in Canada, definitely. But maybe we should take a break, and then when we come back, we can discuss some problems with scientific research on psychedelics.
Shout out to Astapro for sponsoring this episode and providing us with free samples.
Rob, as the local host with allergies here, they sent you some of their nasal spray to treat your allergies. What was your experience like?
Yeah, that's right. I always wrestle with the pollen a bit when it rolls in during the spring. So they sent me the little nasal spray. I tried out the product and yeah, it sure did help me get on top of my symptoms for the day. And it's so fast acting, it was already kicking in before I left the house.
Astapro is a first-of-its-kind nasal allergy spray. It's the fastest 24-hour over-the-counter allergy spray. It starts working in 30 minutes, while other allergy sprays take hours. Astapro is the first and only 24-hour steroid-free allergy spray. Astapro delivers full prescription-strength indoor and outdoor allergy relief from nasal congestion, runny and itchy nose, and sneezing.
Get fast-acting nasal allergy symptom relief with Astapro. Go to astaproallergy.com for a discount so you can get Astapro and go today. A-S-T-E-P-R-O allergy.com. Astapro and go. Use this directed for relief of nasal congestion, runny nose, sneezing, and itchy nose due to allergies.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Rev up your thrills this summer at Cedar Point on the all-new Top Thrill 2. Drive the sky on the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch vertical speedway. And now, for a limited time, get more Cedar Point fun for less with our limited-time bundle for just $49.99. Get admission, parking, and all-day drinks for one low price. But you better hurry, because this bundle won't last long. Save now at cedarpoint.com.
Open a limited-time 11-month certificate at Kemba Financial Credit Union. At 5.25% APY, it's more than triple the national average, plus it's a safe and secure way to grow your money. Visit your local branch or kemba.org/cd for details. Offer expires May 31st, 2024. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. $500 minimum and $250,000 maximum deposit. Advantage status required. Comparison based on bank rate average. Federally insured by NCUA.
All right, we're back.
Now, I think this is a good place to start discussing the fact that there are widely acknowledged inherent difficulties with doing rigorous scientific experiments on the effects of psychedelics. And so one of these problems is the problem with placebo control. Now, normally, when you want to test and see if a new drug works, you need to do a placebo-controlled test. You have to do this if you want to sort out specific pharmacological efficacy versus the placebo effect, you know, the effect that sometimes people who are given a treatment, even if the treatment doesn't have active ingredients, just the fact that they think they're being treated mm-hmm. appears to cause a feeling that their condition has improved. They'll report fewer negative symptoms or something like that. So yeah, imagine you give 100 people a new anti-nausea drug, and then 50 of them report their nausea going away. Was it because the compound in the pill relieves nausea 50% of the time, or could much or all of that response just be due to the placebo effect, to people thinking that they're being treated? So if you placebo control your drug trial to find out if there's a difference, subjects get randomly sorted into multiple groups, with one group getting the actual drug being tested and one group getting a pill that has no active ingredients, then you might be able to get a better idea. If the group who receives the drug gets significantly more of a desired outcome than the placebo group, then you can have confidence that the drug probably actually works. So if you wanted to run a placebo-controlled test of whether, say, psilocybin helps people kick an alcohol addiction and then stay sober for 6 months, you'd want to run a test with people who actually get psilocybin versus people who think that they might be getting it but are actually getting a placebo. So why is this a problem with psychedelics? Well, that's because of the next issue, which is blinding. So the thing you've got to do to have an effective placebo-controlled test is blinding and double-blinding. This is to avoid response biases from subjects and from the people who are carrying out the test. You have to blind the experiment, meaning subjects don't know which group they're in, and the people working with the subjects to conduct the experiment don't know who's in what group. Psychedelics make this hard because most of the time you can definitely tell whether you've received a large dose of psilocybin versus a placebo.
Right. I mean, even if the individual, the test subject in question, has no experience of psychedelic use, there's a very good chance that they have been exposed to some representation of it, some expectation of what the experience is going to be like just through media and culture.
Yeah, well, and the effect of the drug tends to be so powerful on the mind that it's nearly impossible for you to think like, no, I didn't get anything. I mean, no, like if you are becoming a comet's tail of disembodied consciousness, you watch your ego dissolve like sugar in a stream, you're probably part of the active test group.
Right. But even if the effects are not that strong, if the dosage is lower, like, it will be undeniable.
Yeah. I mean, maybe not always, because some people are very suggestible, you know, but the majority of the time, people are going to be able to tell what group they're in. Furthermore, the experimenters can usually tell if the subject they're working with is on LSD or psilocybin versus a placebo. Like, if you know, people who are on these drugs tend to act a certain way that's pretty different than people who are just getting a sugar pill. Now, there are some ways of making this a little bit better. For example, you can use an active placebo, which is a placebo that does something to the body that the subject will be able to sense. One example that has been used in historical research is niacin, which causes physiological effects like flushing of the face and tingling in the body. But still, a lot of subjects and experimenters can probably still pretty easily tell the difference between if you've gotten a large dose of psilocybin or LSD versus niacin. So you still are going to have this blinding problem. But then there's another problem that makes it worse, a problem with conducting psychedelic research the same way you would conduct other drug research. And that is, as we mentioned a minute ago, the importance of set and setting. And I remember it was in the first episode, I think, where we talked mostly about the importance of set and setting. People's takeaways from psychedelic-assisted therapy seem hugely dependent on their expectations, on the environment, and on the guide.
Yeah, I think it was Pollan who pointed out that really the only person to ever take LSD without any expectations of what it might consist of was Albert Hofmann himself.
Yeah, because he took it by accident and nobody knew what it was yet. Yeah. That's funny. But I mean, it's clearly true that people's experiences on these drugs are highly dependent on priming and on stimuli from around them and what they're told going in and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah. I mean, like, for instance, just maintaining a very like calm, therapeutic in a physical environment, having people interact with you, you know, the researchers in question in a likewise manner, that sort of thing.
In other words, I would say to get the most clinical use and the most positive effects out of these drugs, it seems like you specifically want to do the opposite of what you normally do in a drug trial. You explicitly do want to bias the subject's expectations and interpretations of their drug experience in a way that suggests it will help them with their problems.
Yeah, so basically, If you're doing a psilocybin study in which the individuals taking psilocybin are going to be laying on a beanbag chair, for instance, listening to some ambient music, mm-hmm. and attended to by very courteous therapists, you would have to have the same situation going on with the placebo group. And in doing that, you have all of these like situational effects that may well create like something certainly not the psychedelic experience itself, but some sort of comforting, suggestible situation.
Mm-hmm. But this has also been invoked to explain some of the differences in like some of the replication difficulties mm-hmm. that people have had with psychedelic experiments, because sometimes, people in these experiments are given psychedelics with a certain kind of set and setting, and then the replication attempt just sort of gives them the psychedelics but doesn't replicate the set and setting, and finds that, in this study that didn't replicate the original set and setting, people are not getting nearly as positive a benefit. And that just seems to show, again, how dependent the experience is on set and setting.
Well, it comes back to like what the substance does. That even these early researchers, they pretty early on were convinced that it was not something the substance was doing to the body. It was the mind state it was creating.
Exactly.
And what
yeah.
could be gained from that mindset?
Yes, psychedelics seem to be in to whatever extent that they are effective at helping people and have clinical significance, they seem to be more a facilitator of experiences than a direct action drug. It's not that you take psilocybin and the compound cures your alcoholism, but that taking psilocybin allows you to have an experience of profound emotional significance that helps people overcome alcoholism. It seems it's the experience that actually matters. So just say locking somebody in a sterile, uncomfortable white room, giving them a shot of psilocybin without a therapist or guide present is maybe not a very good recipe for getting the most positive effects out of the drug.
Right.
But this is frustrating if you're if you're used to running drug tests, because it seems that when psychedelics have a clinical significance, it is in some ways similar to an active placebo. It just appears to be an extremely effective active placebo. So yeah, there have been these kind of difficulties over the years. I'd say the bottom line is that objective research is so important in medical science, but the standard methods that we have for objective research don't apply especially well to psychedelics, and some methods of achieving objectivity appear to directly counteract the most powerful clinical potentials of these compounds. Another problem we could talk about from the history of psychedelic research is not a systematic methodological obstacle, but it's more like a historical trend that, we're not alone in observing. Other people have mm-hmm. observed this, which is that I would say due to the unique properties of these drugs, a lot of researchers who focus on this subject area appear over time to tend to lose objectivity and become more endorsers and enthusiasts than objective scientists just trying to find out what's true.
Well, I mean, I don't know to what extent it's a lot of them, but I guess the problem is that the ones who do become certainly more noticeable.
Yes.
Their voices are often the loudest.
Right. And I want to be clear. I'm not saying all scientists who work with psychedelics do this, or maybe not, probably not even most. But
right. But some
a significant number yep. do follow this path.
Right. And again, their voices are the loudest. And in terms of loud psychedelic voices, few voices were louder than Timothy Leary's.
Yes.
One example of what you're talking about here, Timothy Leary's work on the Harvard psilocybin project in the early 60s. Some of Leary's methodology there was highly criticized.
Yeah.
And it basically seems like he was intentionally biasing the experiments to make psychedelics seem more clinically useful, which is a shame because the research does actually suggest that they're useful.
Yeah.
It's just he
was being hasty.
He was being hasty. He was taking shortcuts. For example, an example of this is the Concord Prison Experiment, which was aimed at studying recidivism in inmates that were administered psilocybin. And, this is basically the idea. It's like if you give them psilocybin, like how are they going to successfully transfer into, back into normal everyday life, or are they going to wind up back in the prison system again?
Uh-huh.
And so it sounds like a pretty interesting premise, but then the execution was flawed. He looked at recidivism rates 10 months after release for the psilocybin takers, but 30 months later for the control group. And of course, time is vital in all of this because you're dealing with somebody like returning to life.
Uh-huh.
And so like not just like month to month, but like day to day, week to week,
right,
is vital in any kind of study having to do with recidivism. You know, because like that first day back, you know, what's somebody doing? They're, you know, visiting uh-huh. family or whatever. It's as the days go by, as the weeks go by, as the months go by, they're going to have to potentially deal with greater temptation.
Yeah, and he was widely criticized by colleagues at the time for this.
Yeah, Richard Alpert, who was also known as Ram Dass, would later explain that the aim of the project was solid and had a reasonable therapeutic model, but it would have required long-term application and study, and Leary just didn't have the patience for long-term studies. Ultimately, this is something you see throughout Leary's life. You know, this restlessness, this lack of patience, passion, but then a tendency to rush things. And it's almost like he had more System 1 thinking, you know, than System 2 thinking. Mm-hmm. And of course, this is not the preferable balance for serious scientific inquiry.
Right. Now, there was another classic experiment from the golden years of psychedelic research in the 1950s and early 60s, and this one I think we should look at for a minute. This was done under the supervision of Timothy Leary's Harvard Psilocybin Project, but it wasn't, I think, directly carried out by Leary. It was directly carried out by a guy named Walter Pankey, and this was the 1962 experiment with the use of psilocybin to occasion mystical experiences that were subjectively perceived as positive and valid by religious people. And this is sometimes known as the Marsh Chapel experiment or the Good Friday experiment because it took place on Good Friday, 1962. So Walter Pankey at the time was a divinity student at Harvard Divinity School. And the basic details went like this. So you had 20 divinity students in the Boston area, and each got an injection before a Good Friday service at the Marsh Chapel of Boston University. Half got psilocybin, half got an active placebo, which was niacin. And remember, niacin tends to cause flushing and tingling, so they would feel something going on. And the basic findings were that the students in the test group overwhelmingly reported positive and in some cases life-changing religious experiences, and some later rated this experiment, this Good Friday service day, as among the most profound and significant experiences of their lives. But there were complications. One subject on psilocybin had some kind of episode which involved trying to leave the chapel to proclaim a religious message, and he had to be tranquilized with Thorazine. I think they backed off with the tranquilizing people with Thorazine after this experiment.
And these were the researchers, not like the old church ladies.
Right.
who may also keep Thorazine on hand.
The pastor tranquilized him with Thorazine. And so I was wondering, you know, how did this experiment hold up over time? What do people think looking back on it? There have been some later attempts to analyze and follow up on the experiment. One was by Rick Doblin of MAPS, an organization I don't know if we've mentioned already, but I think you'll refer to later.
Yeah, it's the Multidisciplinary Association for Psychedelic Studies. Mm-hmm. And they're involved in a number of research efforts involving psychedelics and also MDMA. By the way, they also are involved in something called the Zendo Project, which aims to promote proper psychedelic peer support, especially for individuals, especially first-timers who are having a difficult trip. Mm-hmm. So I think they've like set up operations at major cultural festivities such as Burning Man before.
Hmm.
But I think this is a really interesting project. I'd like to see how it develops because I think it's an important step if we're going to see decriminalization of psychedelic substances in the United States.
Oh, yeah. I mean, this is something we should continue to explore more as we go on. But I think the idea of having the proper guides who know what they're doing mm-hmm. is a very important part of what might be considered legitimate psychedelic use. I mean, a lot of the research on the clinical significance of psychedelics, we should really stress, is not just giving somebody a compound and then leaving them alone, right?
Right.
You know, it is psychedelic assisted psychotherapy. So you might have a guide, a psychiatrist or a psychologist or somebody who is experienced in working with people a therapist of some kind who either like guides you through the experience itself or sort of holds the space with you while you have your experience and then later helps you talk through it and go through the integration process. I think the idea of having positively socially chaperoned and sort of like expert guided psychedelic experiences is a very important thing that shouldn't be underemphasized. And it's present in a lot of the traditional uses of psychedelics, like when we talked about the traditional uses with the curanderas in southern Mexico. Mm-hmm. I mean, this wouldn't be you just take a drug out in the void by yourself. I mean, you would be guided by someone who is a religious leader.
Yeah, you would have a shaman. And in these test cases, you would have a therapist or a researcher that was filling in for that role. And then outside of the traditional usage or the research or medicinal or psychotherapist usage, there is still room for an individual like that, like somebody that is guiding the experience and setting and attending to set and setting.
Yeah. Oh, but so that was important to mention, but we did get sidetracked.
Yes,
so
yeah, we're talking about Doblin.
The follow-up and analysis of the original Marsh Chapel experiment from 1962. Rick Doblin followed up on it in the 1990s, and he made some criticisms of the original study's methodology. Like he pointed out that there were the problems you would expect with double blinding that we already talked about earlier. There were some imprecise questions in the questionnaire given to subjects to evaluate their experience and a few other things like the original study failed to report the fact that one participant had to be tranquilized. So it seems like something you probably should have mentioned.
Yeah.
And there was also the fact that while on the whole, the students viewed their mystical experiences on psilocybin as very positive and profound, many of them struggled with intense bouts of fear and difficulty and negative emotions at some point over the course of their trips. And this probably should have been reported in more detail than it was, though the experiences were positive overall. But also, so Doblin conducted a 25-year follow-up with some of the seminary students from the original study, and he confirmed that they reported sustained, profound, positive effects from their religious experiences with psilocybin. And I think it's really notable of the Marsh Chapel experiment that this was not like so many of the studies that came before, research into how to treat people's problems like addictions or mental illness, but to use psychedelics in a way to enhance the experience of so-called healthy normals. This was a case where, you know, these people weren't like suffering and needing a treatment. It was like, could they have a profound religious experience that they deemed valid with the aid of these substances? And the answer appears to be yes. But that's a very different question than most drug trials investigate, right?
Right. Yeah. I mean, generally, it is with the aim of curing a particular malady, of seeing if something, if a substance is useful in treating a particular condition or symptoms. But this is more about, if anything, it's about treating the human condition itself, right? Seeing what effect it could have on just sort of baseline human experience.
Yeah. And I think maybe we should take another break and then come back and explore that concept a little more.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Rev up your thrills this summer at Cedar Point on the all-new Top Thrill 2. Drive the sky on the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch vertical speedway. And now, for a limited time, get more Cedar Point fun for less with our limited-time bundle for just $49.99. Get admission, parking, and all-day drinks for one low price. But you better hurry, because this bundle won't last long. Save now at cedarpoint.com.
If a new house is on your wish list in the next 5 years, grow your savings faster and experience your dreams with an Ohio Homebuyer Plus account from Kemba Financial Credit Union. A savings account specifically designed to save for a new home where you can earn 7% APY, a $500 matching bonus, and a $1,500 mortgage closing cost credit. Learn more at Kemba.org. Offer expires March 31st, 2025. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. NMLS 292230. Equal housing lender. Federally insured by NCUA.
Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel. Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI. There's still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI, and Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI in revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better. In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
All right, we're back.
All right, so we sort of know the general outline of what happened in the mid-1960s. There was this significant backlash to what had been, for a while now, at least a decade and a half of interesting and in some ways very promising psychedelic research. But by 1970 or so, drugs were public enemy number one, and scientific research in them dropped off dramatically, encountered a lot of obstacles at that point. And it's only more recently that we've seen this renaissance of psychedelic research. So I guess we might want to look at a question of like, and this is something that's hard to answer in a definitive way, but examining some possible reasons for the cause of the moral panic around psychedelics in the mid-1960s. First of all, I think some of it you could chalk up to a somewhat legitimate reaction to the perceived overenthusiasm of people like Timothy Leary. Yeah. Some of the scientists involved in psychedelic research were clearly not practicing the most rigorous objective science and were in some cases turning into enthusiasts and gurus, something more like alternative religious leaders. And it's not surprising at all that this caused a lot of skepticism and pushback within the scientific community.
Right, yeah, because here's Leary, this kind of weird and at times kind of goofy character, mm-hmm. and at times very profound and well spoken. I mean, you know, he was a very charismatic guy, but you can understand, I think, you know, especially members of the older generation and more traditional folks being a little suspicious of this character.
Yeah. Another big part of the backlash, I think, which Pollan definitely acknowledges at length in his book, is specifically, this is what we were talking about before the break, how scary it seemed that some psychedelic enthusiasts were recommending psychedelics to so-called healthy normals, you know, just regular people. Like, the idea is, well, we're going to tolerate a lot of different methods of treating people who are facing problems, people who have mental illnesses or addictions. And many of these solutions could include drugs, even drugs that have a potential for abuse, because we think, well, it's, you know, it's fighting a problem and it's helping people get better. But what if a drug implies that the whole of society is sick and there's something wrong with the baseline culture that so-called normal people could benefit from using it to affect change on themselves?
Yeah, I mean, it's quite a hard pill to swallow.
Yeah,
you know, to hear, oh, there's something terribly wrong with us, or there's something terribly wrong with the way we're conducting ourselves in the modern world. I mean, this continues to be one aspect of you know, of the problem with communicating the dire threat of climate change, is because there is a certain amount of judgment to be placed on the way that modern industrial society has conducted itself.
Well, yeah, I think that's right. I mean, there's always going to be negative reaction against any indictment that goes to our general way of life. Mm-hmm. Like we want to indict, antisocial abnormality, like the murderer or the, you know, somebody who did something very unusual. But what if everybody is doing something that's harmful? If that's the case you want to make, you're going to have a hard time getting people to accept it.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, ultimately, nobody's going to want – everybody's afraid of change.
Yeah.
And certainly the 1960s were a time in which there was a great fear of various changes, not only the changes that were, offered or at least advertised by, the psychedelic counterculture, but also the fear of change via political ideologies, the fear of communism,
yeah.
The fear of racial integration, mm-hmm. All these various changes that were taking place in society.
Yeah, and so you can definitely see why there's a lot of fear around the idea of treating normality.
Yeah.
So Aldous Huxley and Humphrey Osmond, they, were friends and wrote back and forth to each other in the 1950s. And there was one letter that was quoted in Pollan's book that I thought was interesting, where Huxley was writing to Osmond in 1955 about people taking compounds like mescaline and LSD. And Huxley wrote, quote, "People will think that they are going mad when in fact they are beginning, when they take it, to go sane." And also, as Pollan notes from his experience researching the book, that there's this, quote, "drift from the treatment of individuals with psychological problems to a desire to treat the whole of society." And this drift, he says, is a change that, quote, "seems eventually to infect everyone who works with psychedelics, touching scientists too." And so I think everyone there is probably an overstatement. I think he's, being a little casual. But it does seem to me to be a startling trend, maybe one that should give us pause. I don't know. I mean, it's worth considering that. But like, how many scientists involved in the investigation of psychedelics do end up thinking that it shouldn't just be used to treat people in a clinical setting who are experiencing one problem or another, but it's something that so-called healthy normals should take to improve their lives and improve the whole of society?
Well, I mean, it comes back to the traditional uses of these substances in many cases. They were not necessarily taken purely as medicine for an ailment, but mm-hmm. in many cases just part of, your continued, what would we describe now as, mental health.
Uh-huh. That's a good point. And while we certainly don't want to demonize these substances, I do think also we should be skeptical of that impulse. I mean, it's worth asking the question, is that correct? Or is that over-enthusiasm based on positive personal experiences that people have had?
Yeah. Yeah. And then I guess you could also say it's kind of like if you're acknowledging that there are big, almost impossible problems in the world, wicked problems, as the as we often refer to them, things that seem insurmountable, the kind of problems that make us, that lead us to be convinced that surely only, the return of a savior or the interference by aliens could possibly help us solve. Like humans are just incapable of solving these problems on their own. Then perhaps we might be putting too much stock in the powers of a psychedelic substance to somehow fix that for us on an individual level or a cultural level.
Yeah, I think that's a good point of comparison. I mean, while we certainly don't want to deny the evidence of the potential positive uses of these things, you don't want to make them a god either. I mean, you don't want to drift into the miracle cure mentality. Because what a lot of these studies show, quite frankly, is that there is a lot of potential for psychedelics in treating things like addiction and depression and all that, but they're not miracle cures. It's not like this fixes all your problems immediately and then the world's a perfect place. Now, there's another reason that we can go to explain the anti-psychedelic backlash that I think is probably the most obvious one, right? The countercultural associations with and possible direct effects of psychedelic use. Of course, we all know these compounds came to be associated with rebellion and rejection of mainstream culture and rejection of political authorities. You know, Timothy Leary would proclaim to people that kids who took acid, quote, "won't fight your wars, won't join your corporations." I mean, that's scary to the authorities, right?
Right.
If you think they're not going to fight our wars anymore, how are we going to fight?
They're not going to be a part of corporations. They're not going to found Silicon Valley corporations in the future. Yeah, who would know?
Well, that's funny. I mean, that turned out not quite to be true.
Right.
A lot of these acid takers did turn out to be business leaders. It's obviously not a panacea against business. But I did want to quote a couple of sections from Pollan that I thought were very, very smart on this part. So the first one is where Pollan said, quote, LSD truly was an acid, dissolving almost everything with which it came into contact, beginning with the hierarchies of the mind, the superego, ego, and unconscious, and going on from there to society's various structures of authority, and then to lines of every imaginable kind, between patient and therapist, research and recreation, sickness and health, self and other, subject and object, the spiritual and the material. If all such lines are manifestations of the Apollonian strain in Western civilization, the impulse that erects distinctions, dualities, and hierarchies and defends them, then psychedelics represented the ungovernable Dionysian force that blithely washes all those lines away.
That's beautiful. And that comes back to Terence McKenna's definition of them as boundary dissolving.
Yeah, and I think that's largely correct based on everything we've read. But another passage that I thought was very interesting about this counterculture backlash is it goes like this, quote, "For at what other time in history did a society's young undergo a searing rite of passage with which the previous generation was utterly unfamiliar? Normally, rites of passage help knit societies together as the young cross over hurdles and through gates erected and maintained by their elders, coming out on the other side to take their place in the community of adults. Not so with the psychedelic journey of the 1960s, which at its conclusion dropped its young travelers onto a psychic landscape unrecognizable to their parents. That this won't ever happen again is reason to hope that the next chapter in psychedelic history won't be quite so divisive."
Well, I mean, it won't happen quite the same way again. But as Pollan himself points out, like, he grew up in the dark times he basically grew up in the moral panic period.
Yeah.
So didn't really experiment much with psychedelics when he was younger, and really wasn't until quite recently, as an older man, that he was able to really experiment with them and understand them in a greater sense. So I feel like there are still going to be generational gaps there.
Well, that last sentence may be far too optimistic. I mean, the main part I was thinking about was the beginning of this, where he points out the idea of rites of passage that expand the consciousness. They are supposed to be passed on from parents to children and weave the generations together. And if the young acquire a consciousness-altering rite of passage that the older generations don't have— that can be terrifying to the older generations. It's like they're not our children anymore. They've been initiated into some other tribe.
No, I think it's a great point. I mean, yeah, this was a new rite of passage that the older generation, by and large, had no experience with.
There's one other possible thing going on in the 1960s that I think might be worth mentioning, which is, and well, maybe we'll get into more detail about these studies in the next episode, but there are at least a couple of studies I've been reading from the last decade or so, one from 2011 and one from 2018, that are about adult personality change occasioned by use of psychedelics. So you've got these various ways of measuring personality traits, and people might, you know, your personality might over time sort of be in flux, but, you know, mostly your traits are going to be pretty set by the time you're an adult. You know,
right.
You're around a baseline, you might hover. But there appears to be some evidence that using psychedelics can actually change adults' personalities. And so one of the many things that's been observed is that, for example, use of psychedelics appears to increase people in a psychological personality trait that's known as openness to experience.
Mm-hmm.
People who take psychedelics appear to increase in openness. And openness is actually a highly socially significant personality trait. It's been associated with all kinds of other things in societies in various research. Like, openness is highly correlated with like lack of prejudice and lack of authoritarianism and stuff like that, appreciation for art and for other cultures and things. I think you'd find the openness personality trait largely associated with like environmentalism and multiculturalism.
Yeah, I mean, just if nothing else, like if you were to become more neophilic and you know attracted to new experiences, you become more attractive to travel.
Mm-hmm.
And in traveling, you're exposed to travel itself is kind of I think has a lot to in common with psychedelic experience, you know, where suddenly you're in a place that is mostly the same but a little different. And people around you are different and yet the same. And it forces you to sort of reconsider who you are in the whole scenario.
Uh-huh. So if this is true, yeah, that there are these cascading effects from the use of psychedelics that maybe on a broad scale, say, changing the personalities of a young generation, especially changing them in ways that might not be so congenial to you if you are Richard Nixon or something.
Oh, yes.
That these personality changes could be perceived as a direct threat to the polity of the country.
Yeah, and that's exactly how Richard Nixon saw it. I mean, Richard Nixon is the anti-psychedelic U.S. president by far. Yeah, I mean, it's difficult to unravel all this because on one hand, you have to sort of try and figure out what the 1960s were, you know, like what was the 1960s experience? And certainly you and I were not around in the 1960s, so we can't attest to it. We do have some listeners I know that were, and so hopefully we'll hear from you on it. I remember my father told me once that Jefferson Airplane's Somebody to Love captured what the 60s felt like. But I never had a chance to ask him what he really meant by that. Maybe he just meant it was an iconic song of the time, which it certainly was. I guess that one of the things with the 60s too is that, like all times, you know, the older generation is always going to be concerned with what the young generation is doing and how what they're doing doesn't reflect your values.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I can't relate to the experience of, you know, of grown up in the 1960s. Say a middle-aged person looking at the young generation and asking, "Oh, what are they doing with psychedelics?"
Mm-hmm.
But like maybe on some level, I understand that in regards to Pokemon, you know, where I'm like, "Oh, I had this was not part of my childhood, and yet it's highly influential for these kids. What am I missing? And why should I? And to what extent should I be afraid of it?"
Wait, were you one of those preachers going on TV during the Pokemon craze saying it was causing devil worship?
No. But I do love that kind of. I love the sort of mild moral panics like that. That arise out of any new thing, be it Pokemon or Harry Potter.
I think there was one for Teletubbies.
Teletubbies, yeah. Yeah. The fact that there's kind of a generational divide and a moral panic popping up around something like that in and of itself, I think just is always going to be the case.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we see shades of that. I mean, certainly, I think we have, as we've discussed in the show before and will in the future, you know, we certainly have some issues with mobile technology and with social media. And the effects that those technologies are having on culture.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly, you know, it can lean into some sort of, crankiness where we look at younger generations and say, oh, they don't even know what it's like without social media.
That's our grumpy old men issue.
Yeah.
It's the tech.
Yeah. But we'll have to come back to that. But yeah, so the older generation looked at the younger generation, and they didn't see their values necessarily reflected there. Values that had just carried them through a world war, and of course threatened to carry into one final world war as well. And so it makes sense that these typical generational concerns would be exasperated by the introduction of something new, or at least new from a Western perspective, that was not only consciousness changing, but also foreign.
Yeah.
And remember that most anti-drug messaging in America has depended on xenophobic and or racist messaging.
Oh, yeah.
An association was also made between psychedelics and radical leftist ideologies. So I think that was very much a factor as well.
Well, I mean, one thing that's interesting, I remember from reading the individual testimonials of the people who were involved in the Marsh Chapel experiment. This is anecdotal, so this is only just, you know, the things they happen to report. But I think multiple members of the Marsh Chapel experiment said that, you know, they had their psilocybin experience and it prompted them to go get involved in the civil rights movement.
Oh, wow.
Which, of course, by the conservative authoritarian, white ruling class impulse at the time would have seen that as a political threat.
Speaking of political threats, let's get back to Richard Nixon.
Okay.
So Richard Nixon famously considered Timothy Leary, quote, the most dangerous man in America.
Okay.
And he apparently his handlers were even concerned at different times that leftists might try and slip Nixon LSD.
I'm sure somebody was working on a plan there, one of those 60s pranksters.
Oh, well, yeah. Actually, allegedly, Jefferson Airplane lead singer Grace Slick plan to slip LSD into Nixon's tea at a White House tea party. Because apparently she attended the same college as Nixon's daughter, and there was going to be an event there at the White House. But the event turned out to be an all-female event, so Nixon wasn't actually there. And I think she got scared off by the security and left anyway.
She didn't try to give any to Pat?
apparently not. They didn't quite make it. I think she was accompanied by Abbie Hoffman.
This sounds like an Abbie Hoffman scheme.
Yeah, so it didn't the scheme didn't actually make it through the front door. So mm-hmm. they didn't actually get to that level of decision making. But this all does lead to an interesting question that comes up from time to time, sometimes flippantly and other times quite seriously. If certain world leaders could be tricked into having a psychedelic experience, could we change them? Could there be like a Scrooge moment, right? Would they see themselves objectively? Would they connect with others or connect with nature in a meaningful and life-changing way?
I've heard people say this. In fact, I remember a lot of teenage stoners saying stuff like this. If you just get all these dictators and, you know, we'd stop all the wars if we could just get people to take acid or mm-hmm. I think they'd even just say like smoke weed or something.
Oh, yeah.
Again, I'm very open to and interested in the many of the reported positive effects of psychedelic experiences, but I do not believe it is a miracle drug in that way.
Right, that it can't just in and of itself cure human nastiness.
Especially because set and setting are so important.
Yeah.
I mean, what if you take a drug and
the Nixon White House.
Right. If you have a psychedelic experience where you're just like all revved up on the idea of slaughtering your enemies and stuff. Yeah. I don't know. I'm not sure that would make things better.
Yeah. Like one specific version of this question that I've kind of tossed around in my own head from time to time is not so much, what if Hitler took acid kind of a thing. But if we look at when LSD came into being, it was first synthesized in 1938 in Switzerland. MDMA was first created in Germany in 1912. And in both cases, no one realized what they discovered. You know, it wasn't until later that they took them off the shelf and looked at them again.
Mm-hmm.
But what if these substances had leaked out into Europe, especially Germany before World War II? And granted, LSD would have only had like a year to work its magic.
Right.
But I'm not the only one who's thought about this. For instance, Terence McKenna in Food of the Gods wondered what would it have been like if the Nazis had found out about LSD.
Mm-hmm.
Quote, it is frightening to imagine some of the possible consequences had Hoffman's discovery been recognized for what it was even a moment earlier.
So there, I mean, he's looking at it as not necessarily a good thing for everybody who takes it, but like that it could be a facilitator of great evil.
Yeah, yeah. He may have gone into more detail on this in other works or lectures. Mm-hmm. Certainly, McKenna spoke a lot about these topics. But I am not aware of any additional thoughts he had on the matter. But I suspect that they would have probably done much the same as the CIA did in their experiments with LSD, searching for ways to use it as a weapon or a mind control substance, and then ultimately find it wanting in that regard.
Yeah, and we've talked about this in other episodes of Stuff to mm-hmm. Blow Your Mind in the past. But yeah, that seemed to be the primary focus of like defense-based research on psychedelics in the 1950s is can we get it to make people do what we want against their will or as a truth serum?
Right, and certainly this was the deal with the Third Reich. They were in a state of total war. They were interested in rockets, yes, but they weren't interested because of any space exploration advantages. It was about weapon delivery. It was about pursuing their own awful and racist ideology.
Yeah, this conquest mentality.
Yeah, absolutely. But on the other hand, Hitler took a lot of drugs. Especially after 1941, he was apparently taking a lot of stimulants, a lot of opioids. And you can't help but wonder, right? Like what if Adolf Hitler had taken a bunch of MDMA and LSD in 1942?
Well,
would that have had any effect? I'm suspicious that it would have any effect ultimately.
Yeah, I don't think I buy the stoner line that, you know, just get the dictator to take a psychedelic and they will be cured. I mean— It's hard to know, but I doubt it.
I mean, it would be interesting as an experiment, though.
Yeah.
Just to hook one of them up out there.
Well, another interesting question is, instead of like these individual, say like dose the dictator cases, if psychedelics and psychedelic culture were more widespread in general throughout the world, and throughout industrialized societies going way back.
Yeah.
I do wonder then, like if the common drug of choice among industrialized societies in the 18th and 19th century had not been alcohol, but had been psilocybin or something.
Yeah, and I think that's ultimately the more interesting question, is not what if Hitler had taken LSD or MDMA, but what if they had been at large in German culture preceding the war? And, you know, ultimately, like, the counter argument to that would be, well, there already was a strong bohemian vibe in pre-war Germany, and it was not sufficient to prevent the horrors of the Second World War and beyond. But yeah, I think ultimately when you see people like Terence McKenna arguing for an archaic revival, for some sort of like return, a psychedelically assisted return to nature and interconnectedness, like they are talking about a cultural movement. They're not talking about strategic dosing of key individuals.
Yeah.
If only it were that easy.
All right, we've been going a while. I think we got to wrap it up for this one, but we got to come back in the next. We were originally going to do just three episodes,
right?
But psychedelics took hold, and now we've been going for three, and we still haven't gotten to the 21st century revival in psychedelic research, which we will focus on next time.
That's right. So join us for part four of our psychedelic series here on Stuff to Blow Your Mind. And I mean, who knows? There might be a part five. We have no idea. We have no idea when this is going to end. All right. In the meantime, if you want to check out other episodes of Stuff to Blow Your Mind, head on over to stufftoblowyourmind.com. That's the mothership. That's where you'll find it all. You'll find links out to various social media accounts. You'll find our t-shirt store. Also, if you want to interact with us and more importantly, interact with other folks who listen to the show and have insightful things to share about it and related topics, head on over to Facebook. They have a discussion group there. We call it the discussion module, the Stuff to Blow Your Mind discussion module. You can apply, join, and discuss there.
It's the only good thing on Facebook.
Pretty much.
Anyway, big thanks as always to our excellent audio producer, Maya Cole. If you would like to get in touch with us with feedback about this episode or any other, to suggest a topic for the future, or just to say hello, you can email us at contact@stufftoblowyourmind.com.
Stuff to Blow Your Mind is a production of iHeartRadio's How Stuff Works. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
Rev up your thrills this summer at Cedar Point on the all-new Top Thrill 2. Drive the sky on the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch vertical speedway. And now, for a limited time, get more Cedar Point fun for less with our limited-time bundle for just $49.99. Get admission, parking, and all-day drinks for one low price. But you better hurry, because this bundle won't last long. Save now at cedarpoint.com.
If a new house is on your wish list in the next 5 years, grow your savings faster and experience your dreams with an Ohio Homebuyer Plus account from Kemba Financial Credit Union. A savings account specifically designed to save for a new home where you can earn 7% APY, a $500 matching bonus, and a $1,500 mortgage closing cost credit. Learn more at Kemba.org. Offer expires March 31st, 2025. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. NMLS 292230. Equal housing lender. Federally insured by NCUA.
Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan. For data management practices and additional terms, visit visible.com.
Xumo Play is your destination for endless entertainment. With a diverse lineup of 350-plus live channels, movies, and full TV series, you'll easily find something to watch right away. And the best part? It's all free. Love music? Get lost in the 90s with iHeart 90s, dance away with hip-hop beats, and more on the iHeart Radio music channels. No logins, no signups, no accounts, no hassle. So what are you waiting for? Start streaming at play.xumo.com or download from the app and Google Play stores today. All you can stream with Xumo Play.